Well, we've finally come to it. The last episode of Good People, Cool Things. This show started as a simple concept. Like the name suggests, I wanted to highlight good people doing cool things. I mean, it's not complicated. The first episode dropped back in February of 2020, and little did I know that it would turn into my COVID hobby and then into a full-fledged media production. If you visit the Good People Cool Things website, you'll see all kinds of fun stuff beyond the podcast episodes. There are spotlight Q&As with business founders, musicians, and authors, resources for doing your own cool thing, and even some merch from over the years. I was wearing my Good People Cool Things Texas Taco Capital of the World hat just this weekend, and it brightened my day, while also conveniently shading my eyes from the sun by roughly 38%. I'm not entirely done podcasting. I still host the show Sports Are Dumb, that's R like in Toys R Us, to look at the sillier elements of the sports and games we love. Those episodes drop every Tuesday, and you can find them anywhere you're listening to this show. I've also got my Fun Fact Friday newsletter, which is celebrating its first year next month. That's wild. I should get a cake. Tres leches, for sure. You will absolutely learn something new with Fun Fact Friday, and it's not a clog on your inbox. I was catching up on some emails today and found a mailing list that sent 4 emails in one day. That's too many emails, and I will never do that to you. You can subscribe for a single 2 to 3 minute read every Friday at funfactfriday.com. I have a few other things in the works too, and it's going to be a grand old time. But as always, the spirit of the show was in introducing you to good people doing cool things. And here are clips from 10 conversations that have stuck with me for various reasons. Maybe they were just a very funny conversation. Maybe I've kept that advice with me throughout multiple years. Maybe I just think it's an interesting thing that you'd enjoy hearing. I hope you get as much of a kick out of them as I did. We'll start with Taboo and Super Scattergories creator Brian Hirsch sharing how a board game goes from idea to your table. And as always, thanks for listening. And I do have a goodbye after all of this, so be sure to stick around until the end. Once you have the game idea, and you can take a game that you've created if you want to walk us through this. So how does it go from idea in your head to physical game that we can play?
Okay. It varies often. Sometimes it's 90% perspiration. Sometimes it's 90% inspiration. I'll refer you to one game. I had to drive home in the rain in Los Angeles through a canyon. Traffic was slow, and I'm late for a dinner party at my house. I know I'm in trouble. And on the radio, the news is talking about Ronald Reagan at some remembrance of D-Day from World War II. And I thought, gee, I remember a lot about D-Day. I wasn't there, but you know, we learned history, and I know it was General Patton, and it was Panzers, and it was snow, and I had a list. And I walked in the house, and to deflect my wife from killing me upon my entry, I turned to everybody and said, tell me 10 things about the Battle of the Bulge. And they all started yelling out, snow, Panzers, Germans, you know, Patton. And they said, what are we doing, Brian? I said, it's my next game. And that turned out to be Outburst. But then came the work. At this point, all these years later, we recently were reviewing it. We've written somewhere around 6,000 Outburst topics. Because the game is, you know, it's just been around so long, and we keep trying to keep it fresh. But you got to do the work. And then you got to not fall in the trap of saying, well, if there's a list of 10, that's good enough, put it in the game. But it has to be something people know, something people care about. If I said to you, name 10 pieces of silverware, and you named them, you wouldn't care. It'd be like, I just did this exercise, and I didn't even enjoy it. So you got to really be selective and periodically put in that answer that just irritates people. That emotional component to games is incredibly important, and no one realizes it. If I said to you, 10 cars rich people drive, and you named all 10 that were on the card, that's 10 out of 10. That's as high as it can be. But if you did 10 out of 10 on every single card for an hour, it's a flat line. I want to have you thrilled that you got 10, angry that you got 7, happy that you got 9, annoyed that you got 4. I want you on an emotional roller coaster. It's way more fun than the merry-go-round.
Yeah, I agree. I'm thinking of the last time I played, and it was there was one person in particular that probably was on an actual roller coaster because they were going they were going nuts. It was great.
And that's so factor that in as well. And then a layer onto that, because you asked how you make the game. Now, how does the game physically present? What is the value that you're getting for your money? What makes you feel good about the money you spent to have this play experience? And that's a critical factor. So I'm going to try to find examples, and I'll use this one in my game Taboo. We could have played that game without the buzzer, but everybody loves the buzzer. the first buzzer when I created the game, the first buzzer was made from my garage door opener.
Oh, wow.
And what we'd uncovered very quickly is people were using it to silence their children, to stop an argument with another player. They just pointed at them. But it was a component like a game show. It just felt good. And you suddenly felt, here's this box full of cards. And there's a little thing, a little easel to hold the cards. And there's this buzzer, this toyetic, this piece of toy that just adds so much. And you never felt like you got ripped off, because you didn't. You felt like you got something worthwhile. That perceived value is critically important, but you can't break the bank getting it.
I just need to touch on that Taboo buzzer. We used that on our other podcast, Parks and Rec, for buzzing in on trivia. It's one player has a Taboo and the other one has a Mickey Mouse button that goes, oh boy.
I'll have to send you. We actually have one. It was in one of the editions of Taboo many years ago. It had a you could switch between sounds.
Ooh, that sounds fantastic.
And one of the sounds was So I'll see if I can find it and try and send it to you.
Oh, that would be amazing. You've got the buzzer. You've got it intact. What next?
So you've got the buzzer, you start writing the material, you do the test plays, you see what's working, people are loving it. And now you've got to go and you have your biggest decision. Do you self-publish or do you license it? You know, lots of people, you know, they can't get into the big game companies. It's a closed society. You got to be a pro. It's tough to get in. It's no longer tough to get in when you've already had success. So the question is, how do you sell it? Who do you sell it to? And you're not really selling it, you're licensing it. You're going to get royalties like it's a record. In the case of Taboo, we had built the game. We knew exactly what it was going to cost. We had the title. You know, we already grabbed the copyright and the trademark. We did the things we needed to do before we ever showed it to a company. So I made based on what I knew was in different companies' current lines and what their needs were for the next year. I gave it first to Parker Brothers, showed it to them, left it with them, and they, you know, they're going to think about it, review it, and call me like in a week. Well, the next week, I have the VP from Milton Bradley at my office, and I'm showing him something totally different. And I get interrupted by an assistant who says, can you come out of here, please? Which I'm going, you're interrupting this? And she says, the guy from Parker Brothers is on the phone. So I take the call and he says, listen, I just want you to know. We just, you know, we think this is a negative sort of title. And this buzzing thing is just sort of dumb. And we just don't think this game's ever going to be a success. So we're going to pass. So I walked back into the guy from Milton Bradley. I took out my extra prototype. The first time I went, bzz, he said, I'll take it. So, is it an interesting? Two major players, one sees it one way, one sees it another. I was never offended when a company said, this doesn't fit our wish list right now. This doesn't meet, you know, an important role for us. We're just not interested right now. never offended. That you know, they're not obligated to take stuff. You got to be willing to swing and miss. And that happens. And frankly, I still think a couple of my very best games ever never got licensed, never got built, never appeared anywhere. They're sitting in the back room amongst all those games that just didn't work.
Can we get an inside look at one of those games?
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you that my favorite all-time game that never, no one would publish. It was called Carducci. And it was just this very simple game where everyone was dealt cards and each card had one letter on it. And you had to come up with a word for as many as you could in a row. So if I got a topic card and I read it and it said zipper, that was the word I needed to communicate to other players. And I looked at my cards in my hand and I put down the letters MTSAPC. I laid those down. I said, metal teeth serving as pants closer. Someone yells zipper. I get 1 point for each one of those cards I used. Now I replenish my hand.
I like that.
It's a great game. I've always loved. Never been able to sell that game. I tried it out every 4 or 5 or 6 years to somebody. I've never been able to sell it.
Would you ever release it independently?
You know what? I wouldn't. Just because the retail environment is so changed now. When we started, the big companies were JCPenney and Sears and Kmart and Toys R Us. Those were your big ones. And then who would ever have thought those would go away? But it became Walmart and Target and Toys R Us, and the world changed. And then it went from being the big game companies telling the toy buyer, here, you're going to take these toys this year and we're going to advertise them, to the company saying, we're going to take one and we're not going to keep it in inventory. You keep the inventory. We'll tell you when, if and when we need more. Plan on having a big inventory, but if we don't take it, it's your problem, not ours. And by the way, we don't like the price. So we want it for less, so cheapen the game. So these are the rules of the road. You cost engineer to satisfy your major clients. It's a different environment now. It's a tougher environment than it was early on. So in the case of Boom Again, it is self-published. We have released it ourselves. It tested over the moon, and the reaction told us. So that's the way we went. We did not license it. We did it ourselves. Other games we've done as joint ventures. We've been joint venture partners with a lot of game companies where we share the risk and the reward.
Next, here's Amy Neswald discussing some of her worst gigs on stage.
I have a few pretty worst shows. But the thing is, like, they were really bad shows, but in the end, they're really close to my heart because there was some good stuff in them. There was one show that I worked on called Good Vibrations, and it was so bad that for a year and a half after it closed, whenever reviewers were reviewing bad Broadway shows, they compared it to Good Vibrations. But it was just sort of tragic. It was the book of Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, but it was this like kind of crammed in, like really rough story about a girl with a really cool car who's like driving across the country with these three guys and they're going to go surfing. Right. It was pretty skinny. And then all the girls had to wear like bikinis and they were running around like in the middle of winter. They had to do the Macy's Day Parade in like, pajamas and like bathing suits. It was pretty tragic. But, if you look at that cast, they're doing so well. You have people that are like on Dancing with the Stars and people who are on TV and people who are directing TV. So just a wonderful group. But it was pretty... it was a pretty tragic show. Really fun though. Once we did it, we performed during a snowstorm and like 30 people showed up and we still had to do this show in like a 1200 seat theater. So yeah, so that was one of them.
Well, now I'm kind of curious to hear some of the other ones that you alluded to.
I hope I don't get sued. I also did a show called Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, which was based on the Almodovar film. And it's since played, not with me working on it, so I think they might have worked out some of the kinks. But it was a little bit of a beautiful disaster as well. There are a lot of mechanical issues in that show that we were told wouldn't be issues, and yet they broke down every show, and there was not enough cast. So when someone was sick, there was only one understudy to cover like 12 roles or something. So like, it was like this incredible dwindling cast of characters. There was a big dance number, and at one point there was only one dancer that was able to dance because everyone was out sick or injured. So that was quite something. I don't know, like, I can't think of any other like things that I would classically call bad, but those were two pretty excellent.
Here's comedian Mark Schiff sharing why his two-word phrase is a life changer.
I wrote a book called Why Not? Lessons on Comedy, Courage, and Chutzpah.
I know, I forgot to get the deep throat sound when I said it earlier. My apologies.
It's the phlegm. You got to pull up every ounce of phlegm since you were trying to...
A little chutzpah.
Yeah. So on my COVID vacation, when I found out that we were being locked down, my work, you know, it's a stand-up comedian. That's it. You know, I can't go out live to people. I can't do my shows. I don't know. I got to do something. And I didn't want to be one of these people that just sat and watched TV all day and ate bonbons. I decided to stay creative. So I said, I'll write a book. Why not? Why not write a book? And why not call it Why Not? So I wrote this book. It has 60 essays in it. Some of them were produced already for a place called the Jewish Journal, which has a real nice readership here in Los Angeles. And I had an agent. I wrote a book. I called my agent, Murray Weiss. I said, I think I wrote a book. I think I wrote one. And he goes, I said, would you like to read it? And he said, why not? So he read it. Then he calls me up and said, I like it. Do you mind if I send it out to publishers to see if anybody wants to buy it? And I said, yeah, you know what? Why not? And then we got a call from Apollo Publishers in New York, a wonderful little boutique publishing company. I was with another company before. I have an earlier book called I Killed with Random House, 200 road stories of different comedians. I Killed, True Stories of the Road by America's Top Comedians. So Apollo Publishers read the book. They called Murray. They said, why not? And they called me and we made a deal. And now the book's coming out in less than a month.
Amazing. I was trying to think of a why not response to it, but I'll just say amazing.
I'll give you one, you know. So I got a phone call that you wanted to have me on your podcast. And you know what I said?
I hope it was why not?
Why not?
Yes.
And here you are.
Here we are.
You know, why not is an interesting two words because it's the closest thing to a yes, but you still have a little breathing room. See, when you say yes, somebody goes, you know, you want to marry me? If they go yes, that's it. You're locked in. But if they go, why not? There's a little bit of thing in there that you're not 1,000,000% sure, but there's a drop that maybe why? And you still need a few seconds to figure it out. So why not is a little more comfortable than yes.
I like that. I'm going to get some more why not. I already say why not a decent amount, I think, but I'm going to get more. I'm working it in more.
Two words can change your life. You know, when you get married, it's I do.
Did you try why not? I mean, I guess this was 32 years ago, so maybe you didn't have the
time. No, when the rabbi said, you take her to be your long-term wife, I didn't say why not. I said, yeah, I do. You can't say why not there. I just want to get a big laugh. I should have said why not. You know, that would have been very funny. So, Mark, do you take her to be your wife? Why not? What the hell?
Maybe you can do a 35 or 40 year anniversary you know, a remarriage type of thing, and you can pull it out then.
I can. We'll go to Vegas. We'll redo it. And the justice piece will go, you take her? Yeah, why not? I'll be a little older then, so I won't be as big with the wine. Why not? So, yeah, this book's coming out. It's got a terrific review already from Publishers Weekly. Bill Maher's on the cover of the book. It says, starting out in stand-up comedy with Mark Schiff was a blast. And the humor he brought to the stage back then is now between the pages of this book, plus the wisdom you get when you add time. Bill Maher. Jerry Seinfeld did the foreword in the book. And I got a lot of really great blurbs from a lot of very talented people that read the book.
Now here's singer Kate Watson recalling her face-to-face moment with Lionel Richie on American Idol.
By that time, I was excited. And I was like, you know what? I'm here to showcase what I love to do. And so I went in there. I had a huge smile on my face. Wasn't nervous anymore. I was a little hoarse from being outside in the cold. But I just said, hey, y'all, my name is Kate Watson. And I'm so excited to be here, blah, blah, blah. And I sang What a Feeling off the movie Flashdance. And my own little spinoff version of it. And they told me that nobody in the history of American Idol has ever done that. So I was like, yes. The most memorable part of it for me, for one, doing that with my dad was so cool. That he got to be there whenever they said, you're going to Hollywood. But initially it was Lionel Richie who stood up and he said, Kate, I believe you can win this whole thing. And you're going to Hollywood. And I was in shock. I was just like, holy crap, that just happened. And the part that my dad remembers, eventually you'll hear this from him, but he'll say, yeah, you won. But I shook Katy Perry's hand. And I'm like, okay, great, great. Then from there, I went to Hollywood. I can tell you the whole experience of it all is one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. Because you get there and they had us all stay in hotels with the contestants. They had you wake up at these crazy times, eating at crazy times, and they always had a camera in front of you. So no matter, like, you have to be on point all the time. Like what you say, what you do, they will use it. So, you know, you need to make sure that everything represents you in the way you want it to. And that was hard. And not only that, but being around some of the most talented people in the world, you know, that was intimidating for me at 18. I more was just beginning into what my brand was and what music I knew I was going to be in, you know, like my lane. I just started in it and all these other people are seasoned. They've been doing this for their whole life. And, so that kind of thing, if you're not like truly just confident in everything you're doing, it shakes you to your core. And I got to watch every single person go before me in Hollywood. And I got to see the people who got standing ovations. I got to see the people who totally did horrible. But I knew what song I was going to sing in honor of Lionel Richie. I wanted to do his song, Hello. Before me, I got to watch some people go up there and sing different ones of his songs. And he told them, get off the stage and do not ever sing my song again. That was pretty scary. Once I got to go backstage, they prepare you. You're in a line. They have a camera in front of you, each person. And they go, you have like 5 seconds. How do you feel? And then they send you on stage to sing. And I'm ready. I'm in the zone. I know exactly what I'm going to say and I'm waiting my turn. And as soon as I get up there and I'm like, and they go, how do you, they said, don't look at the camera. And they said something else and it was a dirty joke, but they didn't mean to say it. I start laughing and so does everyone else in that room. And then they shove a mic in my face and go, Kate Watson. So they shove me up there and I am like, laughing, like hardcore, you know, gut laugh. Everyone in the audience heard me and they're just like, what is she doing? And I turned it into, okay, you know, like, we're doing this. So I start dancing, like, having a great time on stage. So Katy Perry stands up with me. She starts dancing, having a good time. And I made my way to the middle of the stage. And I will never forget Lionel Richie asking me, what song are you going to sing? And I said, I'm going to sing your song, Hello. And he goes, this is either going to be really bad for you or really good. And I said, well, Lionel, it's go big or go home. And of course, on the inside, I was shaking, like, hardcore. But I was, like, putting on that confidence face, like, test me, Lionel, test me.
And, who knew Lionel was such a such a rabble rouser?
I know. So I'm going to be completely honest with you. From the moment I started singing, I don't remember. Like, it's almost like I blacked out. I can't tell you if I did good or bad or decent or whatever. All that I know is that whenever I came to, Lionel Richie stood up and starts clapping and gave me this huge smile and a thumbs up. And I am not a crier.
Probably good, based on.
Oh, I was like, okay, I think I did good. Like, and I'm not a crier, but I mean, I was bawling my eyes out. Just, it was a dream come true for me. I did end up going home after that, but I made it. For one, who cares? I got a standing ovation from Lionel Richie. I'm good. Like, my life is complete. I can die happy. But, you know, to be there with that many talented people, it was 140 people in the entire United States or whatever that made it that far. It was an honor to just be that far. So that was my experience. It was unforgettable and grew me as an artist for sure.
Next up, David Shabani dives into memorably bad live shows, including one that featured Too Fast, Too Furious.
It's all about family. I think I got two. One, this one is not as bad as the next. This one time I was playing at this, they said it was a festival. So it's like, yo, it's a festival in this town. And what it was pretty much is that, like, there's going to be like 30 acts playing in different places. And they had me rapping in this, like, this local pizza shop. And I was like in the corner and people were coming in, like, getting their orders. And it was the strangest. I was like, people are not here to watch this. People are buying pizzas. Like, I don't know why y'all put me here. But I will say, even in that show, some people enjoyed the show. So it's like, all right, cool. Well, I guess there's like a crowd to rap in front of us. So I appreciate that. But I always think about how I was in a corner, like, right next to the, like, you know, people flipping the dough trying to make pizzas. And I'm like, all right, well, I guess y'all put me here. So that's what's up. But one show that I really think was the worst gig I had was it was in Austin. This name of the place, I don't think it exists anymore. I think it might be called Headhunters. But it used to be like a metal venue. And for some reason, I got booked at the show. And I it was like on a Tuesday night or something like that. And one of my friends lived in Austin at the time. He went to Texas. And so he was like, yo, where do you play at? You play downtown? I'm gonna come check you out. He came by himself. It was just him. There was another dude in the corner that just happened to be in the bar. And then there was the bartender. And the bartender, you know, when you go to a bar, they have the TV on. Mm-hmm. He kept the TV on. So the TV might have not been, like, the volume might have not been on, but it was on. They had Fast and Furious on. Like, Too Fast, Too Furious, the one with Tyrese. It was on, like, right next to this, like, on stage. So if you're looking at the stage, I don't even know if you're looking at me or if you're looking at the television. So I at some point, I'm looking at the television, like, oh, I like the scene. So they're like, but the thing is, I was honestly rapping to two people and the bartender who's watching TV. And what's crazy is also, they had booked me for an hour set. So I'm over there just doing songs. Like, all right, I guess I'll do this one. I didn't have a DJ at the time. So I'm just like pressing songs on my laptop. Like, I'll do this one. I'll do the next one. And I will say, though, at the end of this show, which I was just like, yeah, I just rapped in front of two people. So that's what's up. Two and a half, if you count, like, half of the attention span of the bartender. But there was a dude that was at the end of the table. when I got done, he was like, hey, this is a long time ago too. So like times, you know, times are different in terms of like exchanging music. Mm-hmm. But he was like, when I got done, he was like, hey, you wouldn't happen to have a CD or something. I really liked your set. And he was sitting, he was just by, it's not like he came to see me. He was just at this random ass bar that had like no one, like, you know, not much going on. And he enjoyed the music. So he was like, yeah, sure. I was like, yeah, sure. I had a CD. And I guess, you know, I presume or assume that that man is still a fan today, but that's probably the wildest gig I've ever played. I was competing with Fast and Furious.
Oh, that's fantastic. I also like that you were taking breaks to watch too.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Sarah Elkins had a pretty backwards journey through the government. So she's talking about that and whether politics is anything like Veep.
When I lived in Washington, D.C., I got a job implementing PeopleSoft products, which was back in the late 90s, early 2000s. It was a really big human resource management product that was supposed to streamline all the processes. And it was a brilliant piece of work. It was brilliant software. But instead of understanding that this was designed to streamline all the common processes that every major organization has, each organization would end up customizing things on it, which just totally ruined the whole idea of it. So, but I was implementing that in the DC area. And so I was working with federal and world agencies there. The last job I had there as a consultant was working with NSA. So I was driving from Capitol Hill in DC up to the Baltimore Fort Meade exit, going on the NSA campus and working with their personnel records. And I can say that now because it's been 21 years since I left, but otherwise I probably would get in trouble for saying that. But I had the highest security clearance a civilian could have, and I was working with NSA. I had worked with World Bank and Federal Reserve and the Department of Education. So I was at federal level. And then when I moved to Montana, I ended up working for the state of Montana for two different agencies. And then when I left the state, I worked for the city, which is the capital of Montana, Helena. And so I kind of went backwards in my government experience, starting at the federal level and moving down to the local level. And I can tell you, none of it looked like Veep. Not any. I kind of wish it did. Scandal, maybe.
Dave Martin was on the first season of Top Chef. What was that like?
I am a reality junkie. That is actually my favorite genre. I don't watch a lot of TV. I just love garbage, a lot of Bravo. So I'd been watching Project Runway and shows of that nature. And so, again, being a recruiter, I was always looking for a better job for myself. I was running a restaurant up in Manhattan Beach, California. And I was always looking for something better. You know, always, that's what you need to do at all times, no matter how great your job is. And, well, it wasn't that great. But there it was, Craigslist. Yeah, actually, Craigslist, old school. It's not just for hookups. Yeah, I totally... it was like, oh, by the producers of Project Runway. Because I was season one OG, like for some of you that are, you know, like 20 years old, like, you know, yeah. Season one, it's a long time ago. I am old. Yeah, so it was Craigslist was how I found out about it. And, you know, just a crazy process and interviews and then coming to the restaurant. And it was very real. We met a shrink. You know, it was kind of a crazy process. And I actually didn't think, because they assured me I'd never done TV, and they assured me, we're going to call you on this day and confirm it. And they didn't. So I totally left town and turned my phone off. And 3 days later, I turned it back on, and there were like 20 messages. And I was like, oh, shit. So I was able to scramble and get back onto the show. But yeah, it was kind of a very Craigslist. I made a lot of money on Craigslist. So it's been a great platform for me. I still use it to this day. To, you know, there are still people that use it as a tool. So yeah, Craigslist, believe it or not.
That's why I got a karaoke hosting job through Craigslist. So I can vouch for that.
Yeah. There's a great consulting job that they were on other platforms, but they still posted old school. I'm still talking to them in LA. And like, that was how I found out about him, and there may be like big money coming from that. So yeah, don't downplay Craigslist. It's not just LinkedIn anymore.
I like it. Is there something, because obviously, I mean, any TV show, but especially reality show, they're shooting way more footage than they're actually going to end up using. Was there something that didn't make it to air, like a behind the scenes thing that you thought was pretty interesting?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's crazy. It's better than interesting. So, yeah, obviously there's cameras going pretty much the whole time aside from when you're sleeping. And one of the guys on our show actually had night terrors. And I didn't know what those were. I was like, whatever. I mean, I was late 30s or whatever, 40, whatever. And I've never heard of that. And he was actually one of my roommates. And so in the middle of the night, he woke up. He was one of the crazy ones. He got kicked off first. You can do the homework. But oh, my God. Like, so me and the other guy, Steven, the Nightmare Sommelier guy, like, we were awakened in the middle of the night, like the first night with him screaming and da-da-da. They had to bring in the paramedics and shit. So it was like, yeah, so night terrors. Yeah, good thing he left after the first night, because that was a rough one. I was like, what is up? Yeah, so that was definitely something they didn't show. And sorry, I hope you don't have night terrors anymore. But that was definitely something that was the like most whatever, you know, and they didn't show us, like, we did drink a lot of wine. I mean, and they didn't get the memo because it was first season for them. So some of the people were like, and we would yell downstairs, wine angels, go get Pinot Noir, you know, because it was like, we needed something to release. So once they started getting the wine, they were like, oh, this makes for better TV. So like, let's just say the wine angel after about day two or three was like very active. There was always new wines and booze when we came home. And it's like, I think it worked out to be a better program for it.
Was the wine angel just one person, or was it a whole team of like PAs?
Oh, I assumed it was a whole team, because I would always scream downstairs and wine angels, please, we need more Pinot and European Sauvignon Blanc. And like the next day it would appear. It was pretty funny, but that did help. You know, one of the things that didn't show up was, again, I am kind of funny in real life, was, and I was out of the cast, one of the ones that maybe watched the most of Garbage Reality. And I was like, you guys, wait, season 10, sponsored by Glad. Like, I was calling it all out, how it has actually played out, like all the sponsorship and all the crazy stuff. I'm like, they'll be in Porsches and da da da, and it'll be super high end. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, we couldn't even get wine. So, and we were riding in like Toyotas or something, but it's very funny. We joked about all the sponsorship and all the stuff that, you know, I knew if the show took off, that would happen. And so it was kind of funny. That was one of the things that wasn't shown, that we really we did predict the future. And our cast was the reason they even have the show now. So, you know, it has to be good in season one. So even though it's a long time ago, we were funny and talented.
I think you're still funny today.
Oh, thank you.
Natalyn Jones has built a successful business, but did she have some bumps along the way. This was her biggest mistake as a founder.
One of my worst moments, probably in my She Warrior journey as a business owner, was bringing on the wrong digital marketing firm. So that was a big learning experience, because I wasn't well versed in the algorithm and all these things. So the company, it was small, but they threw out a lot of words and a lot of things, community building, and it was just a lot of time and money wasted, to be honest. They didn't have anything ever to show for it. And then I stuck with it for probably 4 or 5 months, but when I saw it wasn't going anywhere, I probably should have let it go a little bit sooner. But I'm the person that goes, well, I don't want to be wrong. You know, I want to make sure I'm making the right decision. They seem so nice, you know, but when I, you know, cut the cord a little bit in a nice way, it completely went, they weren't nice. They were weren't nice to me at all, because I didn't want to do it anymore. So that probably, it was a learning experience, but that was probably the worst thing that has happened thus far. But I learned from it, so it's not really an ill, it's a lesson. So.
Yeah, I think that's, and I don't think 4 to 5 months is too long for that too, because it really any kind of campaign or partnership, I think it does take time. I mean, I have a marketing background, and there's times where we'll be like a week into working with someone and they're like, why aren't we like front page of the New York Times right now? And I'm like, because you literally like just launched a month ago. Like it does take time.
Yeah.
Along those same lines too, like that's a good point of their results weren't really showing anything. Like even if it's like, hey, we don't have that New York Times hit, but we've gotten into, you know, some trade magazines, or we've had some people posting about us on social, like you can still point to that. And I think it's, at least in some elements, it's easy to spin like, hey, we haven't actually done anything, but like, here's something that sounds impressive. And I think learning like the difference between, is this actually something impressive or are they just doing that to kind of like save their own butts? I think that's a important thing to learn, and you really don't learn it until you kind of go through something like that.
You're absolutely right. Yes. And that's exactly what happened. And then they kind of blame the failure on myself and some of the team that I had working with me. And I'm like, wait, that's deflection. You know, not saying, you know, we didn't make some mistakes, but you're completely off base. And so, yeah, it was sad. I was like, oh, why are they so mean? I don't understand what happened, you know, but whatever, you know, I move on. They kick rocks. Done.
Kick rocks is such a good insult. I love it. So you kind of did get a taste of social media with that meanness there. You got a little bit.
I got a little bit. Yeah, it's true. I got a little bit, but you know, I think I'm smarter and wiser for it, and I'm still trying to figure some things out. And you know, going through life, you're gonna make some mistakes, but you learn from them. And I've learned a lot, so that's a good thing.
Christine Weatherup recently shot and released a professional movie. You can watch it right now. It's called See You Next Christmas. And of course, she's got some great horror stories from her experience in TV and film.
About 10 years ago, maybe 10 to 12 years ago, so Matt B. and I, the three of us who kind of were at the helm of this film, we were working on a web series that Matt had written and directed, I produced and acted in, and then B was a line producer on it. And we were getting ready for our big finale, the shoot that was going to be the finale episode. And in that episode, we had tons of extras and we had sourced a location. See, it always goes to a location that was a friend's cousin's apartment. We had done a tour of it. We knew exactly how we were going to shoot. And it was the day we were shooting, biggest day. We drive to the location where Matt and I, are there half an hour before everybody else is supposed to get there. As we're pulling up, and he's in one car, I'm in another, and we're talking on the phone. And we're talking, and it's a really nice conversation. All of a sudden, I hear yelling in the distance, and he goes, I gotta go, bye. And I'm driving, and like, what's happening? And as I pull up, I see him having an argument with somebody in the driveway. We find out that even though the tenant had told us that the site was approved, he had not told his landlord that we were going to be filming there. They said, absolutely not. You can't film there. And we have a crew of, in that case, it was probably 50, but let's say the crew was 20. And then we had 30 people, 30 or 40 extras and actors coming in the next half hour for our biggest day. And we had to think fast and go, well, what do we do? And in that case, we were like, well, the only other location we know we have access to right now is our own apartment, which I don't know why I ever agreed to doing that. And so we had to call everybody and say, okay, change of plans, come to our apartment. And then we had to also reconfigure the whole thing of, okay, it's supposed to look like this. And I mean, luckily it was supposed to look like a party and we could make our, you know, apartment look like a party. And we hadn't really cleaned it because we were in the middle of shooting all of this and didn't think like anybody would be coming in. And so it was like a disaster, but somehow it worked out. But it was a little terrifying to have to change your whole day. And it was a big day that we were, you know, the boss who, like the person who is, the company that was giving us the money to make this web series, they were going to visit set that day. And so like, it was very stressful. And then our landlord showed up halfway through the day and was like, what's going on? Like he happened to be in the neighborhood and saw it. And I was like, and I explained the whole story and he goes, you know, for you, it's okay. Which was so sweet. I'm very lucky he liked me.
It's the power of being a good tenant.
I guess so. I was one of his favorites, which you wouldn't think if I'm like filming things in the building that I would be a favorite, but somehow I was nice most of the year. And I think that went a long way.
I wonder what that says about the other people who lived.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I was the favorite amongst just horrible people. No, my neighbors were lovely. I'll say that.
Yes. Yes. I think so too.
They never complained about us shooting movies there either. So I really can't complain.
And finally, here's NBA legend Baron Davis telling a story about his 7-foot teammate Eldon Campbell during a practice.
And Baron, I am a huge basketball fan, so I have to ask. And you can choose either your top three NBA moments or your top three trash talkers from when you were playing.
I would give you a trash talker. Obviously, Gary Payton. He was a trash talker. He was a great trash talker. NBA moment, I would say getting drafted. That was probably like the biggest moment for me. And then I would say another great moment in the NBA. Could be like I made the All-Star game. I don't know. I don't know. Like every moment was big. Every moment was big, but nothing was bigger than getting drafted. Gary Payton, for sure, biggest trash talker. And nobody would ever guess this, but Eldon Campbell, he was the guy on my team. He was my center, starting center. He's the funniest dude I've ever met in my life. And we were running in practice, and we had to run suicides. And the coach was, you know, big guys run for 2 minutes, then guards run. And so when the big men go off, they, like, you know, wait for the guards. And so the big man had ran, and the guards are coming up, and I look over, you know, and Eldon Campbell was hiding behind the guards.
He's hiding?
Oh, man, that's amazing.
He was hiding. He didn't do none of the running. He was starting, like, he would run, and he just, like, run behind the curtain, and it was training camp, so nobody was paying attention. It was hilarious. That was one of my funniest moments. So welcome to the NBA.
Good People, Cool Things will continue to live on. So if there's an episode you missed or one you'd like to check out again, please hit up goodpeoplecoolthings.com. Head to your favorite podcast app. I mean, where you're listening to this podcast, it'll still be there. It'll be like your little cozy friend that you can always come back to. And I've met so many incredible people through this show, and I always like meeting more. So if that's you, reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter, X, Elon's Wasteland, however you refer to that platform. Personally, I use it primarily to find basketball highlights, but I'll chat with you there as well. Thank you to all of my wonderful guests. Whether you're still doing your cool thing or moved on to new endeavors, thank you to Sounder.fm and, after they ceased operations, RSS.com for hosting this show. And most of all, thank you for listening, sharing comments, and making this a super fun part of my life for the past 4+ years. We'll talk again soon.